Thank you, Elizabeth. That's the nicest introduction I've ever gotten and is commensurate with how I felt about having you read my stories for the first time and some of the stories that appear in my book and some of the stories that I hope will appear in other books are the ones that Elizabeth read first. So thank you so much. And just very briefly, Arizona for me was this amazing place. I had been a lawyer and had been pretty miserable as a lawyer. I was working in a horrible New York law firm, making rich people richer. And I hated it. And then I'd never been to the Southwest, and I'd never really been to the West even. And I came to this place, and it was amazing. The light and the color and the air, which is like in the winter, as you know, the air is like champagne. It's so light and delicious. And to be here and to have every morning wake up and it's sunny and it's nice and you sit down and you write stories, that was for me an amazing emancipation. And so I'm so grateful to you, Elizabeth. I know you were one of the people who helped, you know, to shepherd along my application when I wanted to come here, and who obviously helped me a great deal when I was here. All right, I'm going to read you three things. I'll try to be relatively brief. There's nothing worse than writers who come to these things and then read for great lengths. And I think what I'll do is I'll read to you first a piece from the book. So this is from a story called About a Burning Girl, and it's about a judge. It's told in the first person, and the judge is this corrupt judge in the Lahore High Court who is sort of battling his way through life and making money as and when he can. And he has the misfortune to discover one day that his cook, or his bearer, I guess it would be a bearer, which would be like his majordomo, I suppose, or his butler, has gone off on vacation and allegedly killed his wife by burning her to death, which in Pakistan, unfortunately, is a very common way of disposing of undesirable wives. So he is presented with the problem of what to do about this butler. And his wife says to him, "No, I want you to get the guy off. I want him to go free because I want him back as a butler." And he thinks about this problem and realizes that the only way he can get the butler off and get him brought home is by having him sending his own secretary, I suppose you would call him, to the place where the butler lives and to go and bribe the police and talk to the police and do everything that's necessary to get the guy off. Having been a lawyer, I know, and therefore not having been a judge, but having lived in that atmosphere, that delicious atmosphere, I know that, in fact, the guys on top do very little of the work. The work is all done by the guys on the bottom. I, having been on the bottom, I resented this mightily. And so this is a sort of a little thumbnail of the guy who is sent, the secretary of the judge, who is sent to make sure that the butler does not get put in prison. And as I say, it's spoken in the voice of the judge. "The two steeds pulling my career rapidly forward along the treacherous road of the Pakistani judiciary are my wife and Mia Sarkar." Mia Sarkar is the secretary who sent. "Each is in a different sphere, absolutely matchless. My wife, you already know. Mia Sarkar deserves not merely a thumbnail, but a biography in two volumes, if it were possible to find out anything at all about him, except his present rank and station. So far as I'm aware, Mia Sarkar wore a cheap three-piece suit and a pair of slightly tinted spectacles of an already outmoded design on the day that he emerged from his mother's womb. When he leaves the office in the evening, exactly at 5, he doesn't turn a corner or get into a cab or a bus. He simply dematerializes. No one knows even what quarter of the city he lives in, much less his address. He drinks nothing but milk, one careful glassful each day at lunch, and because of his digestion, he eats each day only a single cheese sandwich on white untoasted bread with the crust cut off, brought to him by a boy from a tea stall. Before speaking, he clears his throat with a little hum, as if pulling his voice box up from some depth where he secretes it for safekeeping. His greatest feature, however, is his nose, a fleshy, tubular object, gorged with blood, which I've always longed to squeeze, expecting him to honk like a bus. That would be a fatal act. There is nothing connected with the courts of Lahore that he has not absorbed, for knowledge in this degree of detail can only be obtained by osmosis. Everything about the private lives of the judges and of the staff, down to the lowest sweeper, is to him incidental knowledge. He knows the verdicts of the cases before they have been written, before they even have been conceived. He sees the city panoptically, simultaneously, and if he does not disclose the method and the motive and the culprit responsible for each crime, it is only because he is more powerful if he does not do so. Locked in his impenetrable bosom are all the riots and iniquities of the past and perhaps of the future, and when his mild figure steps out of the law courts of an evening and is lost in the crowds along the Mall, I am irrationally reminded of Lenin disembarking at the Finland station in 1917. He is a man of secret powers and a mover of great events. This is the bacillus my wife sent out to resolve Khadim's case as she wanted it resolved. Mightier men than I fear him. That's Khadim.